So it seems ages since we've seen each other again. What have you been up to this week?
This week I have been doing an R&D, and everybody uses this expression really quite easily and familiarly, but I don't actually know what it stands for. I think it's, I'm gonna have to look it up. I think it's
Well, it's
like
research and development, isn't it? I mean, I know what it stands
research and
for. I know
development.
research and development, but I don't know what it means.
Okay, so I don't know how long they've been called R&Ds, but it was interesting that so it was for the Globe, and they were looking at one of the plays that they want to investigate doing next year. And it was really, really interesting because there were several generations of actors, all who have very different relationships with Shakespeare. And also with the subject matter, you know, you're looking at a very, very old play, but beautifully written play through the prism of different generations who are all looking for, particularly the younger generations, looking for reasons to still be doing these plays.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, it's the Globe, like anything else. It's like the RSC. You sort of think, well, they have to, by virtue of the fact that it's in the title, you know, that you know, the idea is that every generation rediscovers his plays, Shakespeare's plays, all over again. But what was great about them, great about this week, was that everyone agreed that it was too long. So actually what the purpose of the week was to cut it.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Do away with a lot of the stuff. And interestingly, we had long conversations about the role of the fool in a lot of his plays. It was interesting, you know, what you said about the fool in the Danny Sapani Lear at the Almeida, and how he was almost a figment of Lear's imagination that no one else sees. As Clark Peters playing it, isn't it? That except Lear. And it's interesting that there was so much put in for what they call the groundlings, everybody that stood in the
Yes.
pit. And those sort of slap and tickle style jokes that are put in, often the fool was responsible for, but also they're the truth tellers.
Yeah.
And so there's lots of conversations
But they're
about.
also, when you watch it, they're the often, not in King Lear, but they're often the most tedious thing on the stage, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is it. And in the end, one of the fools in this version that we came up with by the end of the week was cut.
Right. Interesting.
And partly because it's interesting, apparently one of the actors who had been at a Guildhall with Patsy Rosenberg would said that the fools were there to dictate the pace of the play as much as anything else. So it gave the main actors either time to have a rest or time to get changed or to get stuff ready for another scene. So they'd come on as almost like a sort of comic interlude.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because you see that in Macbeth, don't you, with the porter. So
Yeah.
you see that's the break for everybody to get changed, and you know, you analyze it. If you do it academically, you analyze it as the change of the mood. But it's really
Yeah.
interesting that's a sort of extension of the fool's role that you yeah, how interesting.
It was interesting. And also talking about the nature of people being prepared to sit through 4 hours of theatre now, which they're not. You know, everybody wants things quicker. They want pace. They want, you know, partly just because that's where we're at, partly maybe that's dictated by social media and the nature of tittle tattle and, you know, screens, and we want it fast. We're not prepared to sit through it and invest in the way that perhaps Elizabethan audiences were, because that was their main entertainment. And so we were sort of doing away with the segues and the links, and it was really interesting looking at how then, you know, Shakespeare does stand up to that. You know, Shakespeare done at speed, potentially even without an interval, you know, light the
Yeah.
trappers.
Well, that was the interesting thing about the Lear. Let me just welcome everybody to
Oh yeah, sorry.
this week's episode of As the Actress Said to the Critic, with me, the critic, Sarah Crompton.
With me, the actress Nancy Carroll.
Slightly late we are, because we've both been so busy, so we've been a bit slow in getting together this week. But actually, yeah, so the interesting thing with the Lear which I very much admired at the Almeida, was that had she run it without an interval and cut it a bit more, I felt I could have done it. You know, I by the time we got to the Blinding of Gloucester, which was 2 hours in, and in fact we had another hour and a half to go, so she couldn't really have done it. But if it had been maybe an hour, I maybe would have sat there. You know, like Pina Bausch's ballets, for example, dance works are an hour or 3 hours, and you don't move from that. You don't move from a three-hour movie. You know, Oppenheimer's nearly 3 hours. So actually you can sustain that if you know you're going to, and if the production's gripping enough. I think that's really interesting with her. You need an interval in Shakespeare sometimes. And also I always think about my dad, that about cutting, because we realised as we grew up, he was a great quoter of Shakespeare and of the Bible, the King James Bible, which he liked, and poetry and so on. But it was only after we reached adulthood that one of his qualities was he cut the bits he didn't like. All the bits that he didn't feel worked. And it really was so brilliant, because there is a bit in the King James Bible which we used at his funeral, and he'd used it at his own father's funeral. And when we came to look at it, he'd cut it. So it ran like a poem, but there were loads and loads of bits that it were not there in my father's version. I, you know, it works. It communicates its message absolutely. Yeah. I love cutting Shakespeare, you know. I think I'm a great believer in cutting.
Well, I mean, you think so much of what we have of his work. I mean, everybody, all the academics talk about different folios and there's memory plays and all the rest of it. It was because so much of it was written down by people who had seen it or in were part of the company and whatever. And it had so many different versions, you know, and they were done again and again. And I think... One, I think they stand up to being cut, which shows that as they're at their base, their very foundation is a great story and great writing. But that also that is the prism, you know, you are allowed. I mean, I think, and I said this quite openly, I think, you know, having done quite a lot of his plays, you know, for many, many years at different times of my life, you know, where you're at in your life gives you such a sort of particular take on it, particular angle. But that more and more you realize that all of them contain great bits, and all of them contain bits that just don't really work. And in some cases, entire acts.
Yeah.
You know, and they call them, the problem act or the problem scene. It's because they're not the best. Yeah. I mean, I'd probably go to hell in a handcart for this, but I do genuinely believe it, because I would always argue for them being done, and I would always argue for kids learning about them at school, because they seem to be the foundation of so many stories, or have borrowed directly from those, you know, from the great Greek tragedies and all, you know, from... or different parables that we sort of go back to, the morality plays and stuff, but you know what we've said before, that there are six basic stories and they're all there. It's all there to be grabbed, and the poetry always takes you aback when you haven't read it for a while.
Yeah, and the characters, I mean, that in a good production, you know, I think of, I always actually often think of Nicholas Hytner as Henry V.
Right.
Which again, he not only cut it a bit, but he actually changed it a little bit, which nobody noticed, and only if you kind of were absolutely embedded in Henry V did you notice it. And in fact, you know, it just had an urgency and an importance and a kind of velocity that took you through the play and made you see why it's still a relevant play, why all these medieval figures can be performed now. And I do think that, I think it's so important. We're talking about it quite recently about, because my view is the text is always there. Nobody's going to burn the text. It exists. It exists as Shakespeare to be read in his entirety by whoever wants to. But the really key thing is to get people kind of hooked on the idea of Shakespeare, and to believe that if he's, you know, if he is the national dramatist, that he has something to say to living in the UK today. And you know, I think it's brilliant. I love the idea of mucking around with it. I've been thinking a lot about this week about Thomas Ostermeyer, who I saw his Enemy of the People, which we've talked about and which I really loved. But I was also reading up about him, and of course, in, you know, in 25 years with the Schaubühne in Berlin, he has done so much Shakespeare, and he's always just approached it completely directly, completely. Yeah. What's the truth of this play? Does it matter if I have a glitter cannon in Richard III? Can, you know, a play be done in the mud? Can we? How do we find the truth? And I love that. I'm really comfortable with it because I think it saves Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Always, you know, more and more people will always love him. As long as you get, I mean, you have, I find it hard if you lose the verse. I mean, if you, you know, if you did a kind of, if you did a production, say, well, I did actually once go to a production of Cymbeline at the Globe, actually, where they lost the speech about Imogen, about where Sweet Violets Land, that went. And I thought, well, that's such a shame. So I have a bit of a reservation then. But nevertheless, you know, I'm always more excited by seeing sort of rethought Shakespeare than I am seeing underthought Shakespeare, I think.
Yeah. It's so amazing, the rhythm of all that. And I think, I mean, maybe that's partly to do with our individual relationships with the plays, you know, and how we came to know them or different productions that we've seen. But then when you see one that's missing moments, you're like, oh, it's like missing a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I remember seeing a Lear, and I can't remember whose it was, where they took out all of Cordelia's interjections at the beginning to the audience. Yeah. I can't even remember what the words are. I mean, I played her.
But I've misquoted Cymbeline, I know. So,
but anyway. Well, no, but the things, you know, where she talks to the audience and says, the hell am I going to say? What can I say? And then she's, well, I've got, you know, and then when he finally turns to her and she says, nothing, my lord. She's already established a relationship with the audience. So when I watched this production and all of those interjections to the audience were cut, probably because the director and the actors felt it was more dramatic for her to, but the first time you hear her voice, to say, nothing, my lord. But then but like you, waiting for Imogen's speech, you're like, no, that, well, oh, you know, because it's that rhythm and our relationship with the words and everything else. But it is interesting, as you say, and so exciting for, you know, for different generations to feel that they can, because again, you know, it's that thing that we keep harping on about, that it shouldn't be elitist, and it is the foundation of so much of our sort of colloquial language.
Yeah.
And that kids should know that.
Yeah. You know, and not feeling scary. I do think that horrible thing of, you know, I kind of remember the first Shakespeare school. So I had a father who loved Shakespeare, and his father loved Shakespeare. Yeah. And, you know, so it was this idea that he was this brilliant writer. And then the first thing we did a play at school, I think, was The Merchant of Venice, which of course is hard, and was hard then, is even harder now.
Yeah.
And we had to break it down line by line. I don't think we even read it through first. I think I actually remember the text. It was a horrible little sort of blue book with everything very close up printing. And
Yeah.
You know, and it was so off-putting. And yeah. I do think, without a father who kind of kept saying, no, it's really exciting. And then starting to see productions that were really exciting.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'd have given up. And I think that's the trouble, that, you know, people think, why should I do it?
Yeah.
I'm incredibly excited. It leads me slightly into, I'm very obsessed at the moment with the director, Emily Burns.
Right.
And she is about to do Love's Labour's Lost at the RSC. And Love's Labour's Lost is one of those plays not often done, because it's, you know, a sort of a king and an enclosed court and a lot of young people being profoundly annoying. But it's got brilliant poetry again, brilliant verse, great songs. It's a lovely thing. But it isn't often done now, and people don't like it. And Emily Burns is they asked her, Daniel Evans, Tamara Harvey, taking over the RSC, said, what do you want to direct? And she said, Love's Labour's Lost. And I don't know anything about it, except that she's kind of got the idea about tech bros and about how, you know, people who are involved in Silicon Valley and in that whole language of new technology talk an enclosed language, live an enclosed life, and they're so obsessed with another world that, you know, they're not necessarily engaging in this one. And that just seems a really interesting way to do it. And I'm particularly excited because my absolute pleasure this week, my total joy this week was to, she has directed Dear Octopus.
Oh, right.
By David Smith at the National Theatre, which I have to say, Nancy, was one of my great evenings in the theatre of recent times, because again, it links with my dad. My dad used to quote Dear Octopus at family gatherings, because that's what it's about. It's not really about much, but it's about the family, who is the Dear Octopus whose tentacles we can never escape.
Yes.
And dad, not every family gathering, but a few, I think, used to make the toast. And he, at a silver wedding anniversary, he bought a couple of an octopus as a present. So it obviously meant a lot to him.
Yeah.
That was my only knowledge of it. Never seen it before in my life. And it's not often done. It's written by Dodie Smith. It was a huge success in 1938, but obviously just that moment of opening pre-war, everything sort of slightly changed. And she went to America. So after that, there's not much more Dodie Smith as a playwright. She goes off to write 101 Dalmatians. And I'd never seen it. And I went with my brother so sentimentally, you know, to see this play that was quoted. And it's a wonder. And it's so beautifully acted and so beautifully directed. And just by doing nothing, by telling the story of a family and all the relationships within that family down four generations, it sort of says everything that you need to know about life in a way. It's an amazing production. And what Emily Burns has done, it's just very, very subtle. She's treated it as a period piece, as a, you know, a play about family. But what she's done is just introduce little grace notes. So they turn on the radio and it's all the build up to war. So it's Eden and so on. It's Chamberlain and all of that. And just the bulletins of the time. And it's nothing, you know, it's not an interjection. It's just while they lay the table, they're listening to the radio, just to remind you that this family is about, which has lived through the First World War, in which a son has died, is about to go through this other great period of change.
Yeah.
And it's magical, so magical. And so it really makes me excited to see what she does with Shakespeare, but it also made me think about family sagas and how brilliant they are. I mean, they seem such a sort of old-fashioned form, but if you count things like The Simpsons and The Godfather and all those things, they are actually just the perfect form for exploring so much of life, really, because you always see somebody you know, or you recognize a figure that you sympathize with.
Yeah. Everything in some way falls into that. I mean, even Star Wars, you know, it's such a model for most stories in terms of how we relate to each other. If that's our formative experience, it then informs most of your life, how you find friends, you know, are you filling gaps? Are you trying to emulate other relationships? Are you, you know, escaping family, or, you know, trying to recreate family, or, you know, that sense of belonging that we all have. And those, the ghosts of family just stay with you forever. There can't be many stories in the whole of life that don't have some element of a family relationship a reader or an audience member or listener will go, oh, okay, well, that's a father-daughter relationship, or that's a sibling relationship, or that's filling the gap because the mother died, you know, when that person was eight, or whatever it is. And it is our formative experience, or the lack of it thereof. You then, you know,
carry on through life,
rest of your life overcoming. It's everything, isn't it? You know, it's like the garden. We, you know, flowers pollinate things. Trees talk to each other, you know, and don't necessarily fruit at the same time. We all share the same air, the same soil, the same pollen, and it's an ecosystem. Families are an ecosystem, and they form the foundation of everything. And
I think they did. I think that's absolutely right. And obviously, everything is, and you're right, you know, it is the Oedipus, you know, so it's one of the texts. Yeah. It's the story. What I feel happened, and what I think is interesting about this Dodie Smith, is that the fashion for domestic drama sort of changed. And so I guess when you, I'm making this up on the spot, so it may not be a very robust argument, but sort of in the 50s and 60s, if you look at what sort of people like Pinter and Osborne did with the family, they are essentially still using family relations, but the kind of political intent and the oddity of the relationships is more clear. And that idea of a domestic drama, which was just a domestic drama, and yes, which through its unfolding reveals truths about love, really, and about, I mean, relationships and class, and it is just, I feel it did go out of fashion. And that I'm so glad in a way that I feel it is coming back into fashion again a bit. Mm. So we both saw and loved Beth Steele's As the Star, Till the Stars Come.
Yes, Till the Stars Come Down.
Clearly, you know, I mean, you know, Dear Octopus could be its cousin, really, only it's a bit ruder and funny and more broad in its humorous effects. And yeah. The more I've thought about that as a sort of family saga, the more I've thought about it as it did have within it, it's got all this stuff about wrongly placed love, which I found so interesting in it.
In Dear Octopus?
Well, in both, actually. So Dear Octopus and Till the Star Has Come Down. People are in love with the wrong people.
Right.
People are trying to find love, you know. Yeah, and it's quite a simple notion, but it does absolutely speak to so much of what goes on.
I don't know the story and I haven't seen it yet, but is that because they've lost people in the first war or?
Yes, it is. And it's actually got a sort of slightly, I don't want to give away too much, but it's got a slightly, I always think Dodie Smith and Nancy Mitford are kind of sort of writing cousins, and that Dodie Smith was the kinder version of Nancy Mitford in a sense.
Right.
But because it's got a generation of family, it's got one sister who comes back and who has a secret about what has happened to her that she reveals. And it's not a very big secret, but it is about sort of having had her heart broken, rather as in, you know, the Mitford, what's the name of that thing? Anyhow. It rather as in that, but also as in Hills of California.
Right.
Butterworth, another sort of domestic setting about sisters, about families, and In Pursuit of Love is the Nancy Mitford. In Pursuit of Love. The Jess Butterworth is also kind of another saga of sisters, mothers, truth coming out. Yeah. And I just kind of see that. In my days when I was running at Art Cess, we always said three things was a trend. And I feel with Till the Stars Come Down, Dear Octopus, and Hills of California, that's a trend. There's a kind of revival of interest in the family saga, and particularly the family saga told through its feelings of its women members.
And also, I mean, I suppose Dixon and Daughters that happened last year, wasn't it? And
it's true. That's definitely a trend.
And it's interesting that a lot of this maybe is post-lockdown, that we're happy to look at, or maybe we've had a little bit of distance from lockdown, but also then it's suddenly familiar again about what it is to be holed up with people you don't entirely, you haven't entirely chosen.
Yeah.
You know, the nature of it, you have your chosen family. And it's interesting that, like with The Ferryman and Jerusalem, that again, that they had a family structure to the characters in the other Jez Butterworth. Huge successes. That with The Ferryman, it was all set around family and extended family, but with Jerusalem, it was a chosen family, lots of lost souls hanging around Rooster as a sort of paternal figure.
Yeah.
No, and it, so the structure again is very, very familiar, but it is interesting that you know that it is this thing about domesticity that, although Look Back in Anger wasn't necessarily about a family drama, it was about people being stuck together in a small space and the claustrophobia of unhappy relationships.
Yes. Yes,
you know, yes. And how people abuse those relationships, or people looking for love, you know, are vulnerable and then are not safe because of their need for that relationship to work. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are sort of similar themes.
Yeah, and I think that's such an interesting thing you say about COVID and lockdown. That hadn't occurred to me, but you're absolutely right that because that threw everybody back.
Yeah.
And I'm conscious of, you know, it, as I go about my daily life, that people still talk about the effect of that time and how it's changed them and their views, either to want to spend more time with their family or maybe to spend less, or to nurture different aspects of their personality. I think has had a profound effect that at some levels we are still reckoning with. And it hadn't occurred to me at all that maybe that's part of what's happening at the moment, that out of that is coming that examination of the most basic of human relationships.
Well, it's we are sort of subconsciously analyzing and, you know, looking at the fallout, really, and that everybody was polarized. You were either thrown together literally overnight, come home, you know, get the last plane, get the last train, cut, you know, who can drive you before everything got locked down, or you were apart and you had to stay apart until everybody said that it was okay and safe again. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, or dropping shopping at the end of the path and then washing everything. You know, it was such an odd thing, you know, having to sort of be 2 meters apart. There was a thing on the radio recently about a guy saying the biggest repercussion will be the 2 meter distancing, you know, more than anything else, more than the death toll, but that, you know, for generations to come. It was interesting. I was on the train yesterday and I suddenly thought about standing close to somebody again. Mm. And how it's absolutely fine, and but that for so long that it wasn't. And it's silly to say, but it's that you suddenly get a flashback, don't you, of when that time when, you know, 2 years ago, whatever, we would have been like, you know.
And that basic longing for a hug, I mean, as well. Hug and a kiss. And there's a dear activist, one of the things, there were two things that were lovely. One is I went for my own pleasure. So I didn't have a notebook. I didn't have to think. I could just absolutely surrender to it and sort of sit and allow it to work on me, which was so lovely. And, you know, the points throughout where both my brother and I could be heard blubbing copiously. But they're also very funny bits, isn't it? There's a character, she's such a good writer, Dobie Smith, and there's a character who's had a who looks very, very young, who's terrified of growing old. And there's a line for the mother, played wonderfully by Lindsay Duncan, where she says she may have had her face lifted, but she still has to lift her legs to get up the stairs. And just had a brilliant line and one plan to use a lot. But what was noticeable about seeing it just, you know, on an ordinary Monday night with an ordinary audience who had just, you know, gone along for the sheer joy of it, was how reactive they were to the relationships being enacted on the stage. And there's a moment towards the end where somebody says no to something, somebody that you're willing to say yes says no. And honestly, it was extraordinary. And it's leading up to a hug, you know, it's leading up to a hug and a kiss and physical contact. And when she pulls away, everyone, no! And it's really interesting that kind of, that people kind of understand that in the depths of their soul somehow now.
You
can make, you know, those wrong choices, those bad, turning down the chance of happiness. I think that's another thing, that they're all plays about turning down the chance of happiness and finding happiness. And I think that's also a new, it's an old theme, but it's a new, it's become newly relevant about how important it is that you live in the moment. One day, it's the same thing again. It's about grasping happiness.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right that really it is reckoning in a kind of subconscious, or maybe in terms of program as a conscious way, with the effects of isolation.
And timing. You know, there's something so palpable about timing and opportunity. And, you know, it's so interesting talking to younger people about how, you know, they're fascinated with how I met Joe and about what that love story is and how you meet people. And I mean, I can't believe it's entirely true that people don't meet, you know, in normal life now, but you, they say mostly there's a safety around meeting somebody online.
Yeah,
it's a controlled environment. And so that the idea of meeting someone in a bar or at a party or through friends is considered old school.
Yeah,
and the desire to meet, the desire to connect is sort of tricky. And one doesn't assume that it will happen for everybody in the way that perhaps there was a time when you just, when you did assume that, you did assume that at some point you'd meet the person that you want to be with. And, you know, whether or not you believe there's one person for everything or everybody or 10 people for everybody, and it's, you know, it's where your ley lines cross and whatever. But that story, that fascination is age old.
Yeah.
And I think genuinely, the thing I always feel at weddings and christenings and is that most people will happiness on other people. And I think it's true of characters that you watch in films or on stage or hear in the radio or whatever, that you will people to be happy through a vicarious longing, either because you are nostalgic about your own life or because you want it in your own life. You know, it's something. So think it, the human stories at the end of the day. I mean, we've said it so many times, but.
Yeah, but I do think that's right. And I think coming to the end now, but, you know, one of the reasons for the success of The Simpsons, for all its brilliance in all other respects, I mean, you know, it is absolutely extraordinary how pertinent, relevant politically it is that they're quite a happy family.
Yeah,
we saw that, you know, Homer loves Marge. They kind of, they can seize the day. They can fuck it up, but they can also function. And I think it's a very odd thing to feel that, you know, a yellow cartoon can make you feel happy. But I think that is why people turn, you know, I always remember that sort of throughout the children's lives, we always just used to turn on the television and find an episode of The Simpsons. If something was going sort of slightly amiss, we would watch The Simpsons, because that is, you know, oddly a happy family. And I think you're right, that longing for happiness is very important. You must go and see Dear Octopus.
Reminds me of Coronation Street as well, and all the soap operas, that there's always such a big deal around weddings on soap operas or when people get together. And it's the thing of that, you know, when you have regular access to people who aren't directly in your lives, but they live in your living room in any shape or form, and you do have that concentrated community of Coronation Street, and that and they're regular, there are sort of usually transient characters, but also the regulars who you've grown up with.
That's really interesting, because somebody tweeted that they were disappointed with Till the Stars Come Down. That they felt that it had was just a sort of glorified soap. But that, I think, is a mistake about soaps, because I think when the soap opera is working at its highest level.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right that it is an image of you know, family relationships, community, that you kind of recognize and aspire to. And it allows you to process your own feelings, your own thoughts through what you're seeing. And I think Till the Stars Come Down does do that, does so in an incredibly sophisticated way. And, it, you know, rather like melodrama possibly shouldn't be a pejorative term. So shouldn't soap opera. I think soap opera, hooray, I like it. Yeah. Dear Angela is a sophisticated soap opera, I think.
But didn't you think that was quite fascinating? Because the one thing that we have both seen is Nye.
Yes.
And that the relationship between the best friend, what was he called? Was he called Arthur?
Archie, I think.
Archie. So there was the best friend, Archie, who was his best friend from school all the way through his life. And then the relationship with his wife, Jenny Lee, who was extraordinary in her own right. And the fact that even when he was unconscious in his hospital bed, watching the dynamic between the childhood friend and the wife and how they vied for his attention, but also it was that your sympathies swung between them, and I found myself at various points sympathizing with Archie and then thinking, but that's ridiculous, she's his wife, and I'd react exactly the same way if anything like that was happening to Joe, and then somebody barged and said, I have all these strong opinions, you'd be like, fuck her off, it's my husband. And you know, but at the same time, you've seen how extraordinary Archie was in bringing Nye out of himself and protecting him and guiding him like an angel, really, all the way through his life. Yeah. And so you and I don't know whether that's a construct of the play or if it really was that like that in their lives, but it's interesting at certain points that you do sympathize with him, I found, rather than his wife. And it's amazing that to this day, one of those facts about Nye Bevan is that he had stomach cancer and he didn't know because that's what she wanted.
Yeah.
And I mean, I found that amazing. It was such an interesting production for...
Right, and it does give you the people do give you a kind of route into kind of quite a... phantasmagoric production, that you know that they, it is true that major ask questions purpose of theatre.
Definitely. I mean, I found it fascinating, but also, you know, in amongst all the political history of what it took to create the NHS and how extraordinary he was, and there is at its core a family drama, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. I think that's a good place to stop.
Yeah.
I should go off and watch a lot of football for the rest of the
day. Oh, very good. Thank you.
I'll probably have a life.
Okay. Well, that's a goodbye then. Did we introduce it in the beginning? I can't remember.
We did. Oh, we didn't remember to do that. Oh. So you can do the goodbye.
Oh, okay. So that's a goodbye from me, Nancy Carroll, the actress.
Goodbye from me, Sarah Crompton, the critic.